You're listening to Trek FM.
Hi, this is Commentary : Trek Stars, a show where we look at the work of Trek creators outside of Star Trek, which means we'll be talking about things that somebody in Star Trek made, but we'll be talking about Gorns periodically in reference to things that aren't Gorns.
Right. And this is our 15th episode, and it's part 6 in our look at Nicholas Meyer as an author. Confessions of a Homing Pigeon. Just to give you a brief synopsis of the piece, the book, it's kind of a coming-of-age story. It's about a character named George Bernini, who is a kid from New York, whose parents are killed in a trapeze accident.
Well, they die.
Yeah, they die in a trapeze accident. He's sent to live with his drunk uncle in France.
Drunk?
Alcoholic uncle in France.
Well, he's French.
Right. And then he's actually American.
Doesn't matter.
And from there, he is sort of bounced around to and from the U.S. And the whole time he is trying to find his way home. And the big problem is he doesn't know what home is anymore because it keeps on changing. Home keeps on getting taken away from him. So
sure, except, I mean, for the most part, it is a story about a guy who decides to go back to France.
Right. That is the basic premise. Once he moves to Chicago and he's living with his foster parents, he finds his life to be in a rut.
The meta-narrative of a guy who's sort of searching for home is only true if you look at the entire thing.
Right.
Like, on the ground, it's more about a guy whose parents are dead, basically at the beginning of the story.
Probably before even the start of the story.
Right, but not, you know, they died from weird circumstances, but not suspicious. There's no foul play involved. The Joker didn't do anything. They just straight up died because they screwed up, presumably.
Yeah.
And then he moves in with his uncle in France. And then he, you know, bums around for a lot of various reasons.
And basically,
in France.
Well, basically, the problem is that the uncle is not exactly the most responsible adult in the world, financially or in terms of parental guidance.
Or in any other way.
Right. And his aunt and uncle on the other side of his family decide that it's in his best interest for them to raise him in Chicago.
Yes.
So after getting yanked out of New York and thrown across the world to France because that's the only person who would take him, he's then yanked out of France and thrown back to America because these people think it's best for him. And in reality, it's not that great.
Okay, except the reality is none of it was all that great.
Well, okay, but in terms of his reality, his thinking, it's not that great, and he decides to make it his goal to get back to his uncle in France.
Right.
Okay.
Except, obviously, this is we're saying all these things. He's you know, a child, like, you know, 10.
Right.
When
it
the
starts
story
off.
Starts.
Well, no, he's even younger than that. He's probably 4 when the thing starts, and by the time
I mean, like, by the time he starts doing stuff.
Okay, by the time he's in France from about 4 to 9, and then he's back in America from about 9 to 14, and then he goes back, or he tries to go back.
The story doesn't really start until he's already in Chicago.
Right.
He's pretty much the beginning of the book is mostly like vague rememberings of goings on.
But it is important because it kind of establishes what his life in France is, what his life has become. So when he does get ripped away from that, you know, even if the story is being told through, you know, like, you know, rose colored glasses or whatever, we know that, you know, it is traumatic for this 9-year-old to be taken away from everything that he knows and brought to Chicago to live.
Sure. I think that I don't think that there's rose colored anything here. This isn't, nothing's rose tinted. I don't think that he never really actually specifies anything about how great it was.
He doesn't think
that like where he is great, or where he is now is terrible, or where he was blah, blah, blah. Everything is just sort of what it is. He doesn't even really have conscious present thoughts until he decides to go back. Like, his first, like, independent thought is, I'm going to go see Fritz. And it's not because he's trying to recapture his life or because he's trying to move back in and reassume that life. It's just because it just makes sense to him.
Well, it's also because he hasn't heard from Fritz. He doesn't know what's happened to him.
Right. His letters get returned.
Right. And but I mean, what I'm saying with the first part, you know, where you're establishing what his life is in France with his uncle Fritz, mm-hmm. you know, while he is, you know, an alcoholic who doesn't know how to raise a kid and who barely has any money to raise that kid, you always get the impression that, you know, despite, you know, messing up repeatedly in his you know, raising of this child, he's giving the kid something which is of a certain value. You know, his life is better for his experiences. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. I don't really think that's so much a thing.
Okay. All right.
I mean, like, this isn't like, you know, Obi-Wan. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the dude.
Right, right. But it is like, but there are you know, there may be some sort of an openness or to certain life experiences that a more strict or conservative parental figure might not have, you know, like being exposed to the arts, being exposed to, you know, what the world has to offer.
Sure, except that he wasn't really aware of any of that. He didn't have any sort of conscious appreciation of these things. Well, what he was exposed to was a different culture. I mean, you're responding to, you know, Frenchness.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, but I don't know. I think that it applies. I don't know. But regardless, it's not just the Frenchness. It's the I mean, there's numerous anecdotes where, you know, he's like, this was obviously a terrible situation. Like when they go to Rome, you know, and you know, he mm-hmm. his uncle Fritz wins a bunch of money gambling, and instead of investing it or doing anything, he essentially
steals it.
Well, whatever. He decides to go to take a trip to Rome mm-hmm. without any sort of regards for, you know, how much money he's spending, how he's going to get back and everything. And in the process, you know, they lose all their money and have to find a way to get back home. They end up, you know, sleeping in the Colosseum one night and all this stuff. And, you know, while this seems like a terrible situation, it created a life experience which was probably much more valuable than had circumstances not put them in this place. At least that's the way that is presented in the story, which is being told from, you know, this kid's perspective.
I think that I think you're reading something into that, because I mean the idea, the way it is presented, it's never presented as a terrible idea. It's never presented like, you know, my uncle was irresponsible and a terrible, you know, like, well, surrogate parent. Like, it's just like, this is how he lived, so I lived with him, and I mean, this is just normal.
No, but there is, so like, you could tell that he as a kid was probably more responsible than his uncle, and he would say things like, you know, his uncle would be like, oh, no, it'll be great. And he's like, yeah, right. And reading it, you think, yeah, right. No, this is not great. And then in the end, it turned out, like he says, his uncle was right. You know, that time and again, his uncle ended up being right about these things.
I think that you're reading more into that relationship that isn't so much there. I don't think that the intention is that he was overly irresponsible. I think that he was a different sort of person.
Well, I mean, that could be. I don't know. Regardless. So just in terms of, I mean, I know that we've sort of gotten into it and everything, but if, you know, people are trying to sort of get a grasp on, you know, what this book is like, it's not like Myers' other books in terms of, you know, it's not a mystery or any of that stuff. It's more along, well, yeah, but it's more along the lines of something like a coming-of-age story like Catcher in the Rye or Almost Famous. Or
An American Tale.
Something like that. An American Tale. Fievel goes
east.
Yeah, to France. But what did you think about the book?
I find it very odd. Like, regularly throughout that book, I kept thinking, like, why write this? Why write this, Nicholas Meyer? This is so particular. This is so specific. Why did you feel the need to write this book? And then, like, later on in the book, somebody mentions Catcher in the Rye, and I was like, oh, he wanted to write something like that. I get it. That makes sense.
That is a thing where I was kind of surprised when they mentioned Catcher in the Rye, because I'm like, really? Are you really going to tip your hand? But maybe that's his way of just sort of acknowledging that this is like Catcher in the Rye. I mean, like there is another scene where he's like, look, you've seen this scene in every other book that's like this, so I'm not going to tell you what happened, but, you know.
Yeah.
And then he tells you what happened, essentially. But, yeah. But
the thing is, like, a lot of the points in this book feel like things that have already read or seen or something. And this is a book where, you know, a 14-year-old decides to get on a, like, essentially leave Chicago and go to France.
Right.
So, like, it's a kid doing something alone for odd reasons that aren't completely fully explored. And I don't think he even really knew, even when he got there. Like, he was more or less doing it because it seemed like the thing to do at the time, because he didn't want to be where he was.
Yeah.
He wasn't so much going to France as he was running away.
Yeah, and he makes that distinction where he says, you know, in the book, he says, like, I've run away a bunch of times and I've always been caught, but the reason why is because I was always running away. I didn't have a destination, and this right. gave me a reason
right. to leave. He selected a place to go.
Yeah.
So he just decided to go back to his uncle in France. But it wasn't like he was returning to the place where he always wished he was. It wasn't like he was returning to the place where, you know, he learned wisdom or any of that. It's just that that's somebody he remembers, and he wasn't able to talk to him, and he missed him.
Yeah.
And so he decided to go there. So, like, at that point, that's where, you know, the story sort of starts going, in a sense. But, I mean, even then, the story isn't entirely 100% going. Because then he, you know, gets on a train, and, you know, he's on the train for a little while. Then he gets to New York, and he hangs out in New York for a little while. And he gets on a boat. He's on the boat for a little while. And he meets a friend on the boat, and he hangs out with the friend on the boat. And then he has sex for the first time. And so, like, this is the story. And then, you know, like, he gets to France, and he, like, you know, walks around, meets somebody that he knew, and they're like, oh, you're looking for your uncle? Oh, yeah, he's down there. And he goes down there, and there's his uncle.
But
his uncle dies.
But the thing about it, right, I mean, the kind of way that the thing is structured, what you just described is, you know, a road story.
Yes, right? But like all road stories, at every point I'm thinking, I kind of just don't want to be here anymore. I'm sick of the train. I'm sick of the boat. I'm sick of all these places. Just get there already. I know that I'm supposed to be really interested in the journey, but you know what? This childhood seems a lot like every other freaking childhood. Like, you know, like, he's moved the landmarks around and he's, like, you know, compressed it, but it sounds a lot like childhood in general.
Did you like it or not? Were you, I mean, were there things that you admired about it? Or generally speaking, did you just find it to be tedious? Or?
No, I was curious. I'm curious about it. Because, you know, once you read this book, I mean, like, the mystery isn't revealed, because I'm still not entirely sure what the motivation was. Because, I mean, like while I could say, you know, he wanted to write a book like, you know, Catcher in the Rye, at the same time, I'm not entirely sure why he wanted to write this book this way. And like, the autobiographical thing, like, I know exactly what that is. I mean, it's supposedly somewhat autobiographical. I know exactly what he was talking about. Of course it's somewhat autobiographical. Of course there's a whole bunch of episodes from his life strewn throughout here. But, I mean, that's what you do. And at the same time, I'm not entirely sure why this is the thing that resulted. It seems sort of peculiar. But, I mean, like, I'm not, like, saying, oh, this is the wrong choice. I'm just saying I'm very interested in why these particular choices were made.
Okay.
Well, not in the sense of, like, oh, this is a great book. Let's explore it. Because, I mean, you know, Nicholas Meyer's works. Sherlock Holmes stuff's cool. Really cool. Tiger Practice is all right. This is my second least favorite of his books.
I really liked it. You know, I wasn't expecting to like it. I was kind of dreading this book. It's definitely his longest book, almost by twice, more than twice in some instances. And I was very, very skeptical, because it wasn't a mystery. It wasn't an adventure. It was, you know, I knew coming into this that it was going to be sort of a coming-of-age story. And usually you hear that coming-of-age story and you're like, oh, man, really? Do we have to do this?
Well, it depends on the story.
It totally depends on the story. The problem
is that this is George travels on various vehicles.
No, but
the novel.
But in the end, I really, really liked it. You know, in some ways, there's some parts of it that I mean, once it got going, I responded to much more than his other books. You know, like his other books, I tend to like on a sort of almost technical level. You know, I enjoy them for what he's doing. Like I can see, you know, the work of the master at play, and I appreciate it for that. But for this one, I was sort of like actually like emotionally invested in it in a way that I definitely didn't think that I would be. For example, you know, when he gets onto the boat, you know, in sort of the last leg of his journey or the second to the last leg of his journey, you know, a love story.
Depending on your way of looking at it, it might be like the seventh to last leg
okay.
of the journey.
All right. But a love story develops. And when it first started, I was like, this is not, no, this does not make sense. I'm not buying this. And by the time it got to the
that's
end.
That's the part where that you, your credibility?
No. I mean, in terms of the love story itself, right? At the beginning of the love story, I was like, I'm not buying this. And then as it progressed, I was like, you know, this is really working. Like, most love stories, we've talked about this on other things, you know, where, you know, you just kind of have to buy that they're in love because it's very hard to convey that in a book or in a movie, you know, why two people love each other.
Hold on. Okay. If you're, I just point this out. Okay.
Okay.
Like I've criticized like the romances in a lot of things.
Right. Yeah.
All right. 2 14-year-olds falling in love on a boat.
Okay.
Okay. I buy that way more than I buy 2 fully grown adults who meet each other on a bus and decide that they love each other by the end of the movie.
Well, I mean, this is what I'm saying, right? like the way that it was presented, the way that, you know, it sort of took you through like the early stages of the relationship, like step by step. It was almost playing out in real time. Like,
but I mean, there is sort of a big chunk of time that is
right. But hopped. But I could buy that relationship. You know, the formation of that relationship, and then, you know, as it progresses and you know, they, you know, have to, you know, split up at one point and stuff like that, I really feel bad for this guy, you know, and the situation that he's in. Like, I totally feel for him. In that way, you know, there's a certain level of empathy which is achieved with this book, which is not in any of his other books at all. But, you know, if I have a problem with the book, it's that I think it kind of suffers from the Dawson's Creek syndrome, where
James Vanderbeek ruins it.
No, but every step,
I'm pretty sure that is the syndrome.
Okay, that's part of it. But I'm thinking of more of the more classical thing, which is, you know,
what is the classical definition of the Dawson's Creek syndrome?
I don't know if there's a definition for the Dawson's Creek syndrome, but certainly something which people have
once you define this, you have to chisel it in stone. By the way,
okay. The characters are acting much more mature than they would in real life, you know, where you can have, let's say, a relationship between these 2 14-year-olds and the emotions behind these things and their actions, you know, on like a surface level could totally play out like this. The way that it's presented is very, very adult. Like, these kids seem much smarter than like when I think about like any 14-year-old that you might see walking down the street, like imagining this book, like in my head, for some reason, the person who kept on popping into my head for this main character, this 14-year-old, like the voice which I heard for this character was Roy Scheider and Jaws. I don't know. Which, I mean, obviously is a much older person, right? But then, like, anytime I tried to, like sort of, like...
Because they're both Jewish?
And, no, I don't know what it was, but anytime I sort of, I think just the speech patterns and stuff. Like, when I try to scale it back to, like, and think about, like, no, wait, he's 14. You know, I'm going to try to get an image of a 14-year-old in my head. I'm like, I don't buy this now, you know? The stuff that he was doing when he was an 8-year-old, I was like, no, this is something that a 14-year-old would be doing. You know, the stuff that he was doing when he was 14 years old, I'm like, that's something that an 18-year-old would be doing. It's just like there seems to be the scale which was slid way back onto
I don't see it that way because I, like, when I was reading this book, I felt that there was The reason I know exactly why this is autobiographical is because this sounds exactly like how I remember my own childhood.
Okay.
It's like when I was 14, I had thoughts like that. But
well,
if you,
sure.
But on the surface is the hard thing to nail. But because we're in his head,
I guess we're seeing it
from his point of view. But I mean, like externally, if you looked at me as a 14-year-old, you would look at like, you know, any other 14-year-old. But I know, like, internally, I was, like, all over the freaking place.
Well, yeah. I mean,
I was, like, really depressed, and I had really bizarre thoughts, and I was, like, all over the place. I was really – I wrote, like, a book a day when I was 14. So, like, I had a lot of thoughts going on. But on the surface, I was – I'd kind of like to have French toast.
Right. Today. And, I mean, I guess that's the thing. You know, and it is written from, you know, let's say an older person's perspective. But you know,
but, I mean, that's the thing. Like, even when I was like eight, like externally, you know, like this, you know, you're 8 years old, but like internally, like, you know, when you were eight, you had a lot of really complicated thoughts. And yeah. Like, there were definitely points where you were like, you know, this is a situation that I'm too young for, but I'm in it anyway. So let's deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, let's deal with what I got to do.
Okay.
But, I mean, that's just how it goes. I mean, like, that's, you know, that's why, like, I sense the autobiographical quality to it, because, like, these situations, he's describing it the way you describe a situation in your own life. And like, if you were to try to understand what a 14-year-old goes through in a similar situation, it's impossible. Because, you know, there's a cultural clash there, and the cultural clash is, you know, the same cultural clash that you experience as a person growing up. It's like the difference between being 14 and 15. You can't define it.
Yeah.
You feel it. And so in order to know what a 14-year-old is going through, you almost have to be 14. And so it's like, it's impossible to do, which is why I know that a lot of these scenes are really close to actual events in his life.
Right. And I guess I see what you're saying. And maybe an interesting experiment would be to give this book to a 14-year-old and see what they think about it. All right, moving on. One thing which struck me as soon as I read the synopsis for this book was the similarities that it has to the story of Dick Grayson, a.k.a. Robin, in Batman.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I started reading this after you described that to me. Because you said, like, oh, we you know, like, it's like, you know, you made a Batman reference. And I was like, what? Batman? What? And like, what's that to do with Batman? And you're like, it's like Dick Grayson, you know, instead of being adapted by Bruce Wayne, was adapted by some French guy. And I was like, so it's not at all like Batman and Robin at all then. So what you're saying is that it's like Batman, you know, without the superheroes and the villains and the capes and Gotham City and Batman. It's like Batman in all those ways, except for all of the things that I mentioned. You know, the things that make it Batman.
I'm just saying, the origin is like his parents are killed, you know, in a circus accident and a trapeze accident, and he's sent to live with someone who he doesn't know.
I'm sorry, but when your parents
bachelor,
are killed,
a bachelor,
period,
who
you're
going
to be
know.
Sent to live with somebody
okay,
else.
Okay, but the fact that his parents died under, as they say, mysterious circumstances, even though there was no foul play involved, in a trapeze accident, and then this kid is sent to live with, you know, a bachelor who he doesn't know. You know, I'm just saying. Obviously. It's not. Although one thing which
I sound like a crazy person. You sound like a crazy person saying that sounds like Dick Grayson.
No. I don't think so. Like, I even sent a tweet to Tristan from To the Journey, and I was like, "Hey, check out this synopsis. You know, doesn't this sound like Robin?" And he's like,
"See, you
it totally
can't say
sounds like Robin.
Does it sound like Robin? You have to say, here, let me tell you a story. A kid's parents die in a circus accident, and then he's sent to France, and he's raised by his drunk uncle. What does that sound like to you?"
Okay.
It sounds like a really depressing story about some kid's life.
Okay, maybe it's just
does
me.
Does not sound like
maybe
Robin.
Maybe it's just me. As soon as I flipped open that synopsis and I was like, you know, a kid's parents die in a trapeze accident and he's sent to live with a guy. I'm like, Batman? This is Batman?
What else is it going to be sent to live with a bear?
A family?
It's going to be a person.
A family? But a one, a, you know, an, a bachelor? You know, who has never raised a kid
oh
before?
That's
I'm
so implausible.
Saying, I'm not saying it's
if
not
my,
implausible.
If my mom had look, died, I probably would have been raised by one of my uncles.
Look,
and
yeah,
you know what?
But would,
they were all single guys.
Here's the thing.
None of them were Batman.
But this is the thing.
As far as I know.
Do you think your mom would have died in a trapeze accident?
If she were a trapeze artist?
Well, that's the thing. Because she's not.
Oh, she's not. Yes, obviously. So you're saying that because the trapeze is part of the story, that obviously Batman at some point is going to become involved.
All I'm saying, All I'm saying is that from the beginning, I thought that I could not stop thinking about the similarities to Robin, and because of this, while for some inexplicable reason the voice in my head of the kid was Roy Scheider, the voice of Uncle Fritz was Christian Bale the whole time.
I can't picture Christian Bale speaking French.
Well, it was Star Trek, you know, because it was Nicholas Meyer Star Trek, so he had the British accent. Moving on from that. In terms of where this fits into his career, you know, this was the first book that Nicholas Meyer had written after making the jump to directing. He had made Time After Time, and then he came back and wrote, you know, Confessions of a Homing Pigeon in 1981 when he was 36 years old. And it was his first book after Time After Time, and also the book that he wrote just before Wrath of Khan. This came out the year before Wrath of Khan. It seems like this is his most personal work. I get the impression, based on, you know, the fact that it's autobiographical, the fact that it's, you know, like twice as long as any of his other books or anything like that, that he kind of, at least when he was writing this, considered it to be, you know, his driving Miss Daisy, you know, as they would say in Get Shorty. You know, this was the one that he wanted to be remembered by. This was his Plan 9 from outer space.
Jesus Christ. How many freaking ridiculous-ass references can you throw into one reference?
I don't know.
This was his driving Miss Daisy, as they say in Get Shorty. This was his Plan 9 from outer space.
As they say in Edward.
No, they don't say these things.
I'm just saying. Regardless of all that, you know, I get the impression, I get the impression that this was sort of like something that he put his heart and soul into, whereas, you know, West End Horror or something like that, he would have done kind of on the side as like a thing to do, you know. Mm-hmm. It was his, you know, like if you were to put it into Spielberg.
What is wrong with you?
Okay, never mind.
This was his E.T.
This is his Schindler's List.
No, it's his E.T.
Whereas, you know, like West End Horror would be his Jurassic Park. Okay, this is his E.T.
E.T. is Spielberg's most personal movie.
Okay, you're right, you're right.
So, yeah, so that's accurate. This would definitely be his E.T. This is not his Schindler's List. Schindler's List, that's Black Orchid. There are a lot of different angles you could take to approach this thing, and like, my feeling is that this was probably the most difficult thing that he's ever written. It doesn't mean that that's the best book or the best read, but, I mean, the fact is, like you can tell that this is somebody, you know, like, who thought, like, I don't really like writing this.
Maybe.
But yeah. I gotta write it because it makes me uncomfortable to write it, so it's gonna work. That's how it works. You know, like, that's the rule. I mean, you know, no tears for the author, no tears for the reader. I mean, that's what he did. He was like, all of those things that sort of defined, you know, how I came into being, you know, like, they're similar to a lot of other people's experiences, and that's why it's sort of universally applicable. That's why I can write it down, and people will know how real it is and how significant these moments were in my life and why they matter to me. And they'll understand it. And because I've changed the names of the characters and I've moved some details around and I've, you know, put it on a boat rather than a bus, you know, things are different. So that's a very difficult process going through that. And I understand why you would want to do that, because it does, you know, it does allow you to you know, write something really important for yourself. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mean, like, this... there are a lot of different ways of approaching something, you know, like, and getting, you know, greatness out of a story. And I think that, you know, the universally applicable moments in youth where you, you know, become a more grown up person, I think that they're fairly well documented things. I mean, one of the reasons why Catcher in the Rye does, you know, get read every year by a bunch of people is because it still works. Mm-hmm. Despite being what it was. I mean, people still do see themselves in that character. They're like, yeah, I can see that. Yeah, yeah. I know what that's like. I've been through that moment. And, like, this book, there's a lot of points where it's like, I know what that feels like, you know? And so, like, there are a lot of things about this book that, like you know, you can find yourself in. And I definitely found myself in some moments in here. And usually you find yourself in things that you think are unique to yourself. Mm-hmm. But it's not.
Well, yeah.
You know, like, the stuff that I found, like, you know, like, that related to me most personally was, like, the cultural clash stuff. Because, like, he was raised in France and America, and I had a little bit of that. And I was never really good at dealing with that logic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I kind of had, like, two different me's.
Yeah.
And I never really, you know, like, put them together until I was much older. So, like, that's that, like, that character's, you know, cultural clash. I understand that a lot.
Yeah.
And if I was forced to live in the other part of the world, I would definitely have got on a boat and traveled back to America.
Well, any final thoughts on Confessions of a Homing Pigeon?
It's really well done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the end result is of a genre that I think is difficult to quantify as being particularly relevant. But, I mean, if you want to know, can Nicholas Meyer write a book that isn't a mystery and still make it work? Hell yeah, he can. Yeah. Black Orchid is not a good example of that. Black Orchid is an example of him writing for a long time that results in very little.
My thoughts on it are basically, you know, yeah, I thought pretty much the same as what you're saying. Thought it was really good. In some ways, I think it's the best book that he's written in terms of, like, the content. Like, I feel like he had the most to say here, even if he wasn't, like, showing off as much in terms of his writing ability.
I think that digging that deep and pouring that much of yourself out onto the table so that the audience can see, that's still showing off.
Perhaps. Yeah, but not in terms of technique.
It doesn't matter. It's still okay. Showing off.
That could be, yeah. Well, that's it for this week. As always, you can find us at CommentaryTrackStars.com, where we do our other show, Commentary Track Stars.
And on Twitter at ComTrackStars.
And email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com.
Those are all the places.
Oh, no, Trek.fm, where you can find this show right here. That's where we are. And you can also go to the forums and talk to us there. We have our own section on a forum. We will be back next week to talk about The Canary Trainer, the final book in Nicholas Meyer's career. So far,
it's also about birds.
We'll be joined by Augie Alexi of Centuries and Sleuths Bookstore. Mm-hmm. And he's hopefully going to drop some knowledge on some Sherlock Holmes, because he is a Sherlockian extraordinaire.
The Canary Trainer is what would have happened to Robin if he had been in the opera and a girl.